Have your Bibles, go ahead and turn to 1 Peter. I may need that. And the fun things about being a portable church is you might leave your Bible in the kids' ministry area because you help set up a screen. It happens. So we're here. You know, Hollywood, I don't think helps marriage out at all, does it? When we were told that movies like the Titanic depict the greatest love story of all times, we can't help but question the depth of any relationship that's only known the other partner for a week at the most, right? I mean, how can that be the best love story of all time? They hardly knew each other. If that's what love is, that we can just, man, I think we got another word for that, right? It's not love. True love surfaces rather when your worst blemishes socially, emotionally, physically, and financially are exposed, and when you find a consistent love in spite of all those things. That's when we realize that, all right, that's a powerful love that's going to catch my attention. If you didn't catch last week's sermon, it's online, and it's worth listening to or re-listening to on your commute this week. Last week, we touched on the inseparable nature that God intended for marriage, and fighting against that, the enemy still does all that he can to put a wedge into every union. Of course, that's true of any and every relationship on earth. Our text today is a gold mine of intellectual and spiritual nuggets that are going to assist us in every union when we wrestle with the text. Let's just dive into the text. And then we'll pull out some of those nuggets today. 1 Peter 3. In the same way, you're going to want to underline that phrase. In the same way, wives, submit to your husbands, so that, to your own husbands, so that even if some disobey the word, they may be won over without a word by their wives, by the way their wives live, when they observe your pure, reverent lives. Don't let your beauty consist of outward things like elaborate hairstyles and wearing gold jewelry, but rather what is inside the heart, the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For in the past, the holy women who put their hope in God also adorned themselves in this way, submitting to their own husbands, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. You've become her children when you do what is good and do not fear any intimidation. Husbands, here it is again, underline it, in the same way, underline that, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker partner, showing them honor as co-heirs of the grace of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. Finally, all of you, be like-minded and sympathetic, love one another and be compassionate and humble, not paying back evil for evil or insult for insult, but on the contrary, giving a blessing since you were called for this, so that you may inherit a blessing. At this moment, some of you are looking at me going, now how are you going to put that in the relevant 21st century context, right? So you want my job? Let's do it. This is what we have here, friends, because this is the bottom line or what's going to help us get to the bottom line. And it's this: consistent love is the keystone to a lasting marriage. Is what we see in this text. We're going to take all kinds of things. We've got all kinds of people that are going to go, wow, Jeremiah, most preachers aren't even going to touch this text in today's culture and society. But we've got to look at this for a lot of reasons. We're going to dive into this. We're going to find four quick keys to consistent love in a lasting marriage. The first one is this that we see in the text. I've asked you to underline it because it's where it all begins and ends. We've got to have the same love as Jesus. If we miss this, we miss it all. If we miss this, remember, my communion meditation, we backed up into chapter 2 of 1 Peter, okay? And we backed up there because Jesus set us an example. Those were the words that Peter uses in verse 21. He has set us an example so that twice, to the wives and to the husbands, we get this note, we've got to love like he loved. We've got to have the same love as Jesus. This that we are asked to do is not something that has not been modeled to us. We have to have the same love as Jesus. We see it in verse 1 in the same way. We see it in verse 7. Some of your translations might say likewise. Again, it's all going back and referring to what Jesus has done. Got to remember that this was a letter that Peter wrote. It didn't have the chapter and verse markings until we went back later and put them in for study purposes. It wasn't like he broke up the letter. No, this is us breaking up the letter. Chapter 2 flowed right into chapter 3 in this letter. In the same way, we go back and we look at what Jesus did. The communion meditation came from chapter 2 on purpose because that love of Jesus, when he elevated us and he put our needs ahead of his, gives us the basis of love in marriage. Verse 21 of Ephesians chapter 5 says this, submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. This isn't a one-way deal. Most people, if they're going to even preach that text in Ephesians 5, they're going to start with verse 22. They're going to start with the word of the wives. Instead of going back to verse 21 and seeing the context there, that there is a mutual submission, that there is a mutual engagement, and it's based on this reverent fear of what Christ has already done for us because he has set us an example of what we need in our homes, in our marriages, in our lives. In other words, Christ modeled the kind of crazy love that's required for lasting marriages to have a consistent love that lasts. So before we look at these other directives for wives and husbands, we have to first look at Christ's model and find our source and example to fulfill our duties as spouses in our culture today. So we're going to look at that more closely as we see the other keys to consistent love and lasting marriage. The next key to consistent love and lasting marriage is that we have to have appropriate submission. There needs to be appropriate submission. Men and women are soteriologically equal. I think sometimes we forget that. Is what I mean by that is simply this. When it comes to God's care and provision for us, he values our eternity the same. His life, his death, his burial and resurrection are for us all as men and women equally. There is, and we saw it even from the beginning. Again, I'm going to requote what I said last week. Matthew Henry's comments in the 16th century on marriage were these. God did not create Eve out of Adam's head to top him or his feet to be trampled upon by him, but near it, under his arm to be protected by him and near his heart to be loved by him. She was created to be helper. That's an equal. That's a come beside. This is not some inappropriate relationship. And so when I say appropriate submission, we're going to see the context here, and it's all about directives that help get it back to equal. Ontologically, that said, when it comes to our functions, though, God did create us to have general roles that differ because of our gender. It's hard to miss that. Only one of the genders can carry children. It's true. Only one of the genders can do that. We have differing roles, and if we don't understand that at some level, now a lot of our roles can intertwine and can complement each other and help each other out, and it's based on the giftedness and personality of the two individuals in our unions. There's great freedom within that to share responsibility, but we do recognize in the scriptures a mutual and appropriate submission that's repeated within these roles. We saw it in verse 21 of Ephesians 5, right? Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. So when we see it then in 1 Peter, we've got to go to the general context of scriptures as well as the immediate context of Peter's letter here to those that have been dispersed among the nations. And so that's just our context to get where we are here. This is what that mutual submission looks like. I'm going to start by saying what it does not look like. It does not mean that we need to be a doormat to do whatever someone tells us to do. And I think that sometimes that's what men in specific have looked at this text and they've been like, all right, I kind of like this word. Hey, Peter, why don't you write another letter, right? I mean, come on, if my wife needs to submit to me, I like this stuff. But we forget the likewise. We forget the same way. That's why the first point's the first point and it's the foundation for these others. Instead, it means to elevate the other person and their needs above our own. Instead of being a doormat, it means that we are one who encourages, one who gets behind, one who supports, and because we value them and we make sure that we're understanding they have needs that we need to elevate. So when we look at this text, here are some appropriate submission qualities that we see in the text. First of all, appropriate submission says that it's not based on deservedness. It's not based on deservedness, because that's what Jesus modeled for us, right? Even when we are at our worst, I love Romans 5:8, God demonstrates his own love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. He didn't wait for us to be good and acceptable, even when we're at our worst. And so in this text, it says, even if our spouse is not obedient to the word, we've got to submit to them. And this isn't new. Actually, you go back into chapter 2, the vocation relationships are there. If you've got a mean boss or slave master, right? And again, we got to understand the first century context where Paul is or Peter's writing this letter. It's in Roman-controlled area where slavery is accepted at the time. And he's just saying, look, you can win your slave owners over. Wives, you can win your husbands over. And then we're getting ahead of myself into that one. But notice, this even goes hand in hand with the first series that we talked about this year, because it's not based on deservedness. Even if our husband disobeys the word, we've got to be submitting appropriately to them. In our first series, the bottom line throughout that whole series was the head, heart, and hands. What God's word says and means to me, I will do. It's got to be something we wrestle with at the head level so that we can own it at the heart, so that we can do it with our lives, because that's the practical application. Sin always starts with the usurpation of God, and so we let Him lead when we begin to obey His words. And so this is the challenge, though. We live with fallen people, right? And so when our spouse is a fallen person, when that very intimate relationship that we live with at home is with another person that's fallen and broken, it's easier for us to say, well, they don't deserve my love. And we just want to cut it off, and that's not what the text says. It says, actually, that gives us an opportunity, and it takes us to the next point that we see in the third part of the first verse there in 1 Peter chapter 3. It says, so that, even if some disobey the word, they may be won over without a word by the way their wives live. So the next part of the next appropriate submission quality is that submission, when it's appropriate, is winsome. If you want to win somebody to your court, you elevate their needs. We serve them, even if they don't deserve it. Maybe especially if they don't deserve it, because that's the same love that Jesus modeled for us. The act of submission is superior to the greatest sermon, is what this text says. There's not a magic formula of words that we can communicate to somebody, but the demonstration that we show them, this consistent love that says, you know what, I'm for you. I champion you, your needs, your dreams. I want to make sure that they make my bucket list. This is of great value to me. Isn't that a beautiful thing? And so this is what's happening in this text, and it's winsome. All of a sudden, we like those people that get behind our ideas and our ideals, and especially when they get behind them, pointing them to God's ideals so that we can mutually be in submission to Him, loving the same way that He loves, having a righted relationship with Him so that we can have right vertical relation or horizontal relationships with other people. The next submission quality that we see is this is a visible thing. And it's very clear in the text here that it is visible. Look at verse 2, the first part of it there. It says this, when they, referring to the husbands, observe your pure, reverent lives. And ladies, I may need to just say this, because sometimes is what I hear from women more than I hear from men in conflict and relationships is often this. I can't get him to talk to me. Anybody have that experience with guys? Wow, guys are just like, well, we don't talk, right? They don't say a word. But ladies, I'm going to tell you something. Even if you're a talker and you're getting it out there, this is free, okay? They hear it all, but your husband, what he doesn't say with his words, he's communicating. Because we always communicate, even non-verbally, right? We can communicate with our appearance. We can communicate with body language. We can communicate with downcast eyes. And so, ladies, this is free. This is what you say, because, guys, I'm going to come back to you here in a minute. This is what you say. Is what I'm hearing you say, they didn't say a word. Is what I'm hearing you say is that you don't feel good right now. I don't know why, but is what I'm hearing you say, because we listen not only with our ears, but with our eyes. And guys, this is the same deal. For some of you, you've heard him say it, right? And it's time for us, and we're going to get to that in a minute, but we are going to observe their pure, reverent lives. And it's something that is visible. It's something that is seen and noticed. And ladies, if you don't think your men notice, I want to tell you, or partners, if you don't think your significant other notices, it's a visible thing. We notice. Our spouse sees our actions. But you know what? This is the bigger piece. Maybe you missed it. You need to underline another piece of the puzzle there. If we go down to verse 4 again, talking that this message that we portray, and I'm going to skip over some of that, but as we get to verse 4, it's inside the heart, right? And what's the last statement of verse 4 say? This is of great worth in whose sight? In God's sight. So not only is our spouse seeing our actions, let's not forget an important piece. Everything we do is visible to our spouse, and it's visible to our Savior and our God and our King. Everything we do and everything we don't do is visible there. And so we've got to know that even if we feel like they don't hear me, or they won't talk back, or whatever the communication struggle is, we can know that what we do is seen not only by our spouse, but by our God. Okay, notice the next quality that we see in this text. This is something that not only is visible outwardly, but it's also something inside the heart. It's inside the heart. And on account of that, it's more valuable than any outward beauty. And that is the inner beauty of high character. And we know that in life, right? You apply for any job, and one of the first things that anybody that hires anybody knows is we want somebody of high character, because people of high character are going to show up to work on time. They're going to do their piece. That's certainly true of people that we're looking for to be in relationship with, right? We want them to show up and do their part. We want to make sure that we're not having to fight them with addiction and disease and everything else, because we have vetted the process, whatever our process is. And so it is, we look at this, we want to see high character. Let's take a deep breath with me. In this verse, ladies, it says to have a quiet spirit. And this has been a misspoken thing for a long time. Some of you just wish I wouldn't even taught on this passage, right? You know what? The word for spirit here is pneumatos. And women, that should be a breath of fresh air. Go ahead and breathe with me. There's another word that we translate for spirit or soul, psyche, psuche in the Greek. And if this was the psyche, then this one, that might be a little more challenging for us to go, all right, then I've got to be quiet. I can't have my personality. If you know my wife, I did not marry a quiet woman. But you know what having a quiet spirit means? A quiet spirit doesn't mean we can't talk and share our viewpoints. This is what the quiet spirit means. It means that I have a spirit that is at rest. I'm not anxious. I'm not living in fear. And I'm not expressing fear at every turn. I have a spirit that is stilled and it is quiet. And why is it stilled and quiet when we look at this text? Because of this high character that's in my heart does not stem from my husband or my spouse, because I'm not trying to please my spouse or my husband first. I have wrestled with and identified why my spirit is at rest. And friends, this goes a long ways, because some of you in your relationships here, there's tension because we're always bringing up what might happen on this mortal soil. We're worried about yesterday instead of focused on how do we make sure we don't do yesterday again like we did yesterday again. And yet next week comes and we're still talking about last week's yesterday, if you know what I'm talking about. And we keep living there, and it keeps bringing up some friction here because we don't have a settled spirit that is quiet and still. We haven't understood what Psalms 46 means when it says to be still and know that God is in control of this mess. And when we can have a settled spirit, then even when we talk, and it's okay to talk, ladies, all right? This text does not tell you to be quiet. And if your spouse is to ever to preach this text and to tell you this means that I can't talk. It's not what the text says. It says that my spirit is quiet and settled so that when I talk, I've got a platform to encourage because after all, I'm here elevating my spouse. I'm making them better. I'm getting behind them. I'm their cheerleader because guys are not very good at cheerleading each other because why? We don't even talk to each other to know how to cheerlead each other. And so, wives, you have a great opportunity. And so when a helper is needed, as all Peter is showing is that, look, if you want to come up and get beside your husband, this is the best way to do it. And it comes from this spirit that is settled, that is at rest, not because of who our spouses are, but because our relationship with God is restored, even if our spouse is disobedient to the word. You see how big that is? But notice, this isn't Jeremiah telling us we need to do this. If you're hearing this as Jeremiah's words and statements, don't forget the very first phrase, in the same way. We're doing this because Jesus went first. He modeled this same love so that we can learn this kind of lateral love with other people. And then notice the fruit of this. I love that there are examples given then. There are holy women like Sarah in the second half of verse 5 and 6. Where was their hope? It was in God. Their spirit was at rest because they weren't trusting in their husband. They were trusting with God. And because of that, they submitted their husbands, not because their husbands deserved it, but because they were their husbands. Their yes meant yes. And they were adorned. They were winsome. And they got to share in the wind, something visible. We can tell about them because of the inner character that they had. And that said, I want to add one more piece to this puzzle here. And that said, women, it's okay to be beautiful. If you want to know what I mean by that, if they're going to bring up Abraham and Sarah, Abraham knew his wife was so hot that twice they went to different countries and he had to tell her, just tell them you're my sister because I'm afraid that because of your beauty, they're going to take you. So Sarah was beautiful, and so they're using this as an example. But guess what? As all this text is saying is, if our beauty exists only of outward performance, then are we living to please God or are we living to please our husbands? Sorry, husbands, you're not that big a deal, all right? You're a big deal, but not as big as the big G, okay? And that's all that this text is saying. So there, now you know what the text says. I've done my job, right? Woo, pray for me. Consistent love is the same love as that Jesus had for us in this way. It also models appropriate submission. Let's look at the third. Consistent love. And the key to that is having a shared life. Husbands' directives are now turned on us with another in the same way in verse 7. In the same way, husbands, underline that, because we're going back to looking at Jesus' love for us again. In the same way, because he did this, we've got to understand and notice the importance of the word with or together that shows up in this verse. We have the same problem that Adam had. Even though Adam was placed in a perfect world in Genesis 2:18, it wasn't good for him to be alone. He needed a helper, suitable. And so God gave him a helper, right? In the same way, we were not meant to do this alone. We want to live independent, but we need somebody to come alongside and to share life with. But friends, so does our spouse have that same need. Our spouse needs to share the adventure of our life with us. As we shared last week, friends, we are weakest when we are alone. And I think that that was known. And that's why God said, look, Adam, it's not good for you to be alone. I need to give you a helper for this life. And so notice in this text, verses 7 and following, the qualities of the shared life. I actually think it's just 7 there. Foremost, it begins with an understanding of our wife's weaknesses. And women, this is not a degrading verse. I'll get there. Whew. is what this text says is that men, we don't do a very good job of understanding our wives, partially because we don't talk to them. It says, live with them in an understanding way. And this is the hard part. This takes work. The visibility of their lives and their livelihood is seen. We know that. Sometimes it's the same. We want to get out of ruts. We want to try to change molds, right, in the same way that they want to change our molds. And moldy relationships are just that. They're gross, okay? So we get out of molds and we get out of ruts. But the best way to do that is by this communication. And it doesn't happen if we never understand each other. And so if we want a relationship that is unbalanced to get balanced, then this verse says that, look, if you are looking at your spouse as a weak partner, then that means we've got to do extra work to bring him to level. In the same way that Christ did for us, because we are certainly the weaker partner there. We understand what it means when Jesus says, come to me, you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest, or you will find rest for yourselves. And then it goes on to tell us what that rest looks like. He says, take my yoke upon you. What's he meaning? All of a sudden, Jesus, I thought you wanted me to rest. Now you're saying, I've got to yoke myself with you and we're going to get some work done? What kind of rest is that? This is the rest he means. We're the weak partner. He's going to do the load. We're going to get to do the walk beside. Yesterday, I took all five of our boys to Baker Wetlands by myself. Yeah, I'm a nut. And we're out there. I got 2 1-year-olds, a 4, 7, and 10-year-old, and we're out there. And the 4-year-old wants to help push the stroller. I've got one in a front carrier. I'm pushing a stroller. And 4-year-old wants to help me. There's 2 handles, and he wants to do a handle all by himself. And I keep reaching over to help with his handle because you kind of need equal force so that we're not in the mud on the side of the gravel road. We're in the middle on the gravel, right? And he's like, well, why are you helping me? And I'm like, because you need help, right? And that's the way this relationship is. We need help. And so God comes alongside of us. And guess what, man? You think your wife is tough because she does everything. If you've got a super wife like mine does, she does way more than she needs to do. And all of a sudden, we've got to recognize that, wow, if I don't come alongside of that, we're going to be in the ditch. And we've got to put in some effort, and that's the understanding way that is mentioned here. I love the example in the book. I'm going to get there in a minute. Sorry. Getting ahead of myself. Man, if we take the time to listen to our wives and understand them, we'll be better husbands and fathers and citizens in general, not to mention the ideas and the giftedness that God has given our wives. When we can understand and appreciate what they bring to the table, Our relationships will flourish and express themselves, not in a dominating way. And I think that's why Peter adds the statement of giving them honor. Let's read this verse again. Verse 7. Husbands, in the same way, live with your wives in an understanding way as with a weaker partner, showing them honor as co-heirs of the gift of life so that your prayers will not be hindered. We also give them honor. And this is what that means, husband. This is an opportunity for us to parade our spouse, to speak pride about her. This includes public as well as privately. That means when you're with her and when you're not with her. Honor her not just with what she needs, but with what she wants. That's what honor looks like. And don't miss this. Inasmuch as we were never meant to be there by ourselves, neither were our wives, God desires for us to honor her, to help meet her needs and her wants. Why? This is why. Because from the beginning, she has been a co-heir of the gift of life. And this is where, if you're a reader of books, John Eldridge is wild at heart. Maybe even if you're raising boys, if you've got a boy that you're raising, you're going to go, why are these boys like this? Good grief. This does a good job of sharing guys' 3 basic needs. But the cool thing, ladies, all throughout his book, he says, and to my women readers, he also parallels women's 3 basic needs and how they are so complementary to each other. But this is what he says. Men have one, as one of our basic needs is to live an adventure. But where many relationships get railroaded at this level, it's this way. Because as men, we have gone to live our adventure and we've forgotten that we've got a partner in this adventure. And so we think, well, I can just leave her at home with the kids, right? I mean, that's this cultural trend that happened. And it put us in this place. And women have a need to share an adventure. And if we're going to yoke ourselves with somebody, we have an adventure not just to live, but an adventure to share, because we are co-heirs of this gift of life, and we've got to be doing it together. Many marriages drift mission at this point because one spouse leaves the other and their kids behind. And friends, it's not just a husband's leaving their wives issue anymore. This is happening the other way around at an increasing level too, because we've gotten this idea that we are independent, we're not codependent. We've gotten this idea that my needs and wants don't need to be mutual. My adventure doesn't need to be a mutual adventure. It just can be my adventure. And so we go and live my adventure, finding ourselves on an island someday at some point, because we've lost the art of what it is to be co-heirs in this gift of life. Now, I'm not saying, nor do I believe this text is teaching, that we have to do everything together. I've met some of those couples. Zach's here. Brian and Laura Burke. Man, they amaze me. Don't they amaze you? A couple that lives together, works together, plays together. They are always together, and they like each other, and it works. And I think it's cute. But it wouldn't work in the Holcomb household, right? And I love my wife, and we do a lot together. Work, we plan a church together, and that means that there's going to be a lot of evenings that we're together. But her giftedness and my giftedness are different in some areas, and the way... this is what they say about my wife. She is so extroverted that I got to get this in, because next week she's going to preach with me again, all right? So last year when she preached with me, remember, she threw me under the bus and said I was the fun killer at home? So this is the deal. They say that Megan, when we were assessed, and the psychiatrist that was looking at a marriage to see if we could uphold the stresses of church planning, because it's supposedly stressful, don't ask us. But in this journey, they said, wow, Megan, you might be the most extroverted person we've ever met, and only a brain injury, and maybe not even a brain injury, could even change that about you. So that Megan, like, always has to be around big groups of people, and I'm an extrovert, but I'm not near what Megan is an extrovert, and I need some time by myself. And so it is that we've found ways to make it work with us. So this text doesn't say that we've got to be with each other every second of the day, but what it does mean is that if we're going to have an adventure, it's a shared adventure that understands the other partner, that honors them, that makes sure that they're in it. And if you're on one of those poles, my grandparents spent very little time together, and they had one of the most affectionate, cute marriages in the world because of their giftedness. My grandpa was up at 4 o'clock in the morning. My grandma was up at 10. My grandpa went to bed at like 7 o'clock at night. My grandma went to bed at midnight. And yet they had a little bit of time together. I think it was called lunch. But they had a great marriage. Maybe that's why their marriage was so great. I don't know. But this is what I know. It doesn't matter where we fit on the scale, as long as we get that we share this adventure. And then, man, if there's not a gut kick to end that verse, the last quality of a shared life is this: it includes a fulfilled prayer life. This Pray 752 campaign, I want to tell you, it's as much about this relationship at the level of spouses as it is taking the faith to your kids. Because I want to tell you, the hardest one of these, I guarantee you, is not the 7. It's not the 5. It's going to be the 2. It's going to be 2 times making 15, 30 minutes valuable enough to say, how can I be lifting you up to the one that matters most? And friends, if we're not sharing our life with our spouses, we don't even know what to lift them up to the Lord for. And I want to tell us what the scripture is telling us, that if we don't learn the art of loving in the same way that Jesus loved us and taking it to this level, our prayers may hit deaf ears, not because God is ignoring us or doesn't care about us, but probably because we don't pray what He wants. We're probably praying selfish at this point, and He is going to tell us no when we need to hear no. But if we are honoring our wives, if we understand her, if we are lifting her up and doing our share of the load, recognizing her status in that, then guess what? Our prayers are even going to be heard. Isn't that big? A shared life is a valuable piece of having a, and it's a keystone and a key to consistent love in our marriages. Because God values marriage, the very first organization that He made, and He wants that for us too. Let's look at the fourth key to consistent love in marriage, and that's simply this: it takes resolute commitment. It takes resolute commitment. If you recall last week, I talked about how sometimes in life we hear a sermon and or we've just gotten so good, or even our Bible reading, right? We just scroll it, man. It's about getting it done, right? We just read the text and we're like, oh, cool, next, right? Because there's always more information come in. In verse 8 and 9, this is one of those where it is really tempting just to scroll this. And I want to tell us, if you want to camp out the rest of your week, if there is anything to do, get the in the same way, get these other things, but get this resolute commitment. And camp out on these things. Because in order to accomplish this list in verses 8 and 9, we cannot love half-heartedly. To be true to the context, this includes marriages, but it exceeds that. It goes back into chapter 2, and it includes all of our civic and vocational relations as much as it includes our familial relationships and our relationship with God. That said, if we do not do these at our home level, we are unfit to do them outside of the home level. And we're being hypocritical. So now when we speak of resolute commitment, we're speaking of a commitment that doesn't change its course. It only focuses on the goal. And as Christians, that goal is to love God and to love others, restoring their relationship with Him because we have a restored relationship with Him. On account of that, resolute commitment in this text looks like these things. I'm going to read verses 8 and 9 again because it's such a big deal. Finally, all of you be like-minded and sympathetic. Love one another and be compassionate and humble, not paying back evil for evil or insult for insult, but on the contrary, giving a blessing, since you were called for this, so that you may inherit a blessing. And this is the list. We're going to want to scroll it. I want to tempt you this way. Get your phones out, because by the time I get to the last point, you're going to want to take a picture. And you're going to go back to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 9 and 8, and sit here this week and say, okay, this is probably the area that I need to work on in my relationships. And this is where it begins. Resolute commitment looks like this. Like-minded. That means we've got to get on the same page and have the same mind. If we don't know what our spouse or significant other is about or where we're going, if we don't have the same end goal, we're going to struggle. And it begins there. And that's true in our work relationships, right? If the boss and the company is going this way, but I think we need to go this way, there's going to be a rift after time. And that's true of anything. We've got to be like-minded, being on the same page. Sympathetic. I hate this word because it's hard. I like empathy more than I like sympathy. You know why? Because with empathy, you can suffer and I don't have to suffer. I can just walk along your suffering. That's what empathy means. But sympathy means I've got to suffer with you. That means your hurt hurts me too. That sucks, right? I mean, I hate sympathy, right? Let's not hate it so much. Once we start finding out that we can have a little bit of sympathy in life and we can suffer with somebody, it helps the like-mindedness. It helps these other areas. But that's the difference between empathy and sympathy. Now, this word loving, this is one of the surprise words, because most of the time we see love in the Scriptures. What word is it? We talked about it last week. It's the agape love, the love of decision. This is not one of those times. This, we get the Philadelphoi, the ones who are loving their brothers. Brotherly love, right? Philadelphia. This is where we're getting it now. What does he mean? I actually think that in some cases, this is the more difficult kind of love. This is the familial love. I love you because you're part of my family. And let's be honest, sometimes it's our family members that are the hardest ones to love, right? Good grief. Because we know them. And so it's hard to love them. And we get bound by whatever family that binds us. We're part of that family, and there's always a piece of that puzzle. But even so, that's what this word loving is here in this case. Tender-hearted or compassionate, depending on your translation, is the next word that's listed. It actually has as a root of this word, usplonkno, and splonknidzo is my favorite word in the Greek, and it's the word for compassion because it means literally from the bowels, right? Like when you are moved by something so much so that you can't help but act, like a bowel movement, right? I mean, sometimes it just moves. And so that's where compassion starts with, and it's a fun word. How many words, splonknidzo? Just say it once. It's kind of freeing. I mean, you get a spirit that's at rest. You just want to say splonknidzo on a few times and occasions after you've studied Greek, because it's a cool word to say. What in the world? But this word, tenderhearted, it's because we have compassion. All of a sudden, I'm not going to be staunch. I'm not going to be hard. I'm going to take time to care, and instead of coming with a heavy hand, I'm going to come with reason and respectability. And that's why the next word's thrown in there. It's also humble. These are the qualities of a resolute commitment. And see, it's easy to scroll these things. It's a lot harder when I have to stop and go, yeah, my approach hasn't always been with humility or with a tender heart. And then we get a couple negations that I put into one. We don't pay back evil. We don't pay back insults, right? We don't give evil for evil or insults for insults. And if we go back into chapter 2, that's part of the same love, right? Jesus, when he was being put on the cross, he didn't insult back. Instead, he loved. And then the very last two, it also includes giving blessings. And the neat, beautiful, fruitful thing is we don't do it for this reason. This should just be the byproduct. When we have a resolute commitment, we inherit blessing in that relationship. Because when we've done all we can to give, God usually blesses it. And that blessing gives us opportunities to enjoy the adventure that we're on. I'm sure this list is one of those that, again, we can quickly scroll. But would you camp here this week and think about our vertical relationship with God and our horizontal relationships with mankind? It makes sense that division happens when we aren't on the same page, right? When we're not like-minded. So get on our spouse's page this week. It takes resolute commitment to our spouse and to our marriages to have the same mind and the same goals. It also requires sympathy. It takes time to listen to the hurts of our spouse and to let them get on us. Friends, we communicate verbally and non-verbally all the time, and most often sympathy isn't a communication issue, it's a commitment issue. Well, I didn't know you were hurting. Well, I've seen your arms folded and the tension, or I've heard you yelling all day. And is what I've found in life that hurting people hurt people and healthy people help people. So obviously I'm hearing you say that something is off. And I need to let your hurt get on me a little bit, because that's what it's going to take. That's what sympathy looks like. If we want to level up this year and in our marriage relationships, this is a big one. Suffer with your spouse. Let their suffering hurt you so that you can help get out of the suffering together. Oh, that we would take a day to question our loving nature. Man, I believe that Philadelphia is almost more difficult than agape, because agape says, I love you because I said I would. It's not based on your deservedness, but Adelphoi says, I love you because you're part of my family. I really don't have a choice. Agape love, I chose. I decided. Adelphoi, we're yoked. And that includes my siblings. That includes my work relationships. I don't know why they hired you, but you're here. So I got to love you. And it helps if we reframe it to say, I get to love you. Because there are opportunities in every one of those circumstances. Because people are the greatest and worst parts of this life, aren't they? And when we get this, we're going to get it. And it's going to take some tender-hearted compassion to stop and to think about the words and the tone. And we all know what humility means. It means that I am going to be wronged. And I'm going to elevate my spouse, and I'm not going to pay back that wrong with a wrong, because nobody wins in relationship restoration when conflict is present. But the fruit is that we give blessings and we get blessings. The bottom line today is simply this: smother your relationships with the same love of Jesus. Smother your relationships with the same love of Jesus. And friends, that's going to take us to texts that people have taken out of context to mean a lot of things that they were never intended to mean. But when we let them add value to these relationships that God values so much and has valued since the beginning of creation, letting His love be the model that lets us smother our relationships with that kind of same love, we find blessings going and coming, and He gets the glory. And friends, if we don't have a settled relationship with Jesus Christ, I want to give you that opportunity today as well. The band is going to come, and you know, I think sometimes we think, as we even sing the words of the song, nothing is impossible, that's one thing that may not be possible. How could God forgive me for what I've done? We think of the skeletons that we held. For some of us, the addiction that we hold on to, not because we want to, but because it's really holding us, and we want to break it. That depression, that mindset that says, I need this, and so I invite you. We've got the Worleys and the Keithleys are here, and Irma's here, and Melissa's here. They're all quality prayer team members. If you want somebody to pray with and make this decision of faith, or just you just want somebody to pray with, we give you these opportunities in our worship experience on purpose, because the enemy says we don't have to talk about this kind of stuff, right? But we can't get help that we don't talk about it, and that even means the communal opportunity to pray together. So go to one of the back door areas during this song if you'd like, or even after the service, grab me on your way out, and let's give God the glory for this. God, we just thank you for smothering us with your love, leaving heaven and doing everything in your power to come and to save us. And really, when we think of the month of February, this month of love and an opportunity to love, we recognize that nobody can love like you did. And yet we're encouraged that you believe in us enough to challenge us to love like you love. That means that we can have glimpses and hints and whiffs of that kind of same love. And so God, help us to love our children, our significant others, our parents, our coworkers, our friends, with that same love that you loved us with, God, so that we can be agents of change in this world, and so that you can get the glory in Jesus.